From WBUR Boston, I'm Sheila Cast, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. New Orleans and much of the Gulf Coast digging out through the damp rubble of ruined houses and ripped up roadways, of families scattered and jobs gone. This week, New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin laid off 3,000 workers. The city is still struggling to identify its dead and to reconcile its vibrant past of jazz music, Cajun cooking, free spirits with its stark present. We'll talk to clarinet player and composer Michael White, historian Douglas Brinkley, and writer Jason Berry about what they lost and the future of a city that they claimed as their own. This hour, On Point, the uncertain future of New Orleans. But first, we begin in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, for the latest on the reaction to Ray Nagin's announcement this week that he would lay off 3,000 city workers, and for news on the red tape surrounding the releasing of dead bodies. Nick Riccardi is Denver bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times and has been in Louisiana covering the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina and Rita. Hi, Nick.
Hi there.
So tell us what the repercussions are of these city layoffs.
Well, it's hard to gauge. It certainly kind of just adds to the general sense of demoralization out here. The city still doesn't know where all of its workers are. They presume they're laying off some people who have other jobs elsewhere where they relocated to, but it's definitely going to be a blow to, 3,000 people and their families. And it's kind of a reminder that in the best case scenario, New Orleans is going to be half the city it was for the mid-future.
Well, how do they even know who to lay off in terms of what services are less needed than others?
Well, they're trying to preserve kind of the essential services needed to get the city back on its feet. So, fire, medical, and police will be largely untouched, although not entirely. Some of the back office people will probably lose their jobs. Sewage, sanitation, water, business permitting and health inspections that would be required to get restaurants and businesses open again, those will be largely preserved too. But everything else, in the bureaucracy will go, and probably people around the edges of those departments will go too. Even the coroner's office, which is completely overwhelmed, has been told that everybody who hasn't reported to work yet is going to have to go.
That's amazing. How many people are working in the coroner's office? Do you have any idea?
Well, their regular staff is about 35, and about a third of those are working up here in the Baton Rouge area in a temporary morgue. And the New Orleans coroner said yesterday that the people who haven't showed up, some of whom have jobs that are like lab technician, which are somewhat redundant right now because there is no lab being run by the city of New Orleans, he's going to probably have to let go.
But there are huge problems with the body count, as I understand it. Tell us about that.
It's been it's an extremely difficult circumstance, just because of the situation where you've got bodies scattered around the state, and some of them are in pretty advanced stage of decay, and so that it's challenging from the get-go. But it's obviously been complicated by some real bad bureaucratic headbutting. You've got basically the state, you've got local coroners, and then you've got a FEMA team kind of that all are trying to interact, and there are some basic problems where the local coroners will say, hey, we need this equipment, and FEMA will say, well, talk to the state, and they'll talk to the state, and the state will talk to FEMA, and stuff just doesn't get done. It takes some time, and because of that, they've only released fewer than one-tenth of the bodies that they've actually gotten a month after the storm, and people want to move on and mourn their loved ones and bury their remains.
Well, let me back up. What at this point is the count on victims? How many victims of Katrina do we think that there were?
In Louisiana, as of yesterday, they put the toll at 988, but they stressed that that number is going to go up and down significantly over the coming months. They just got a call from, I think it was the Houston coroner's office, saying that 53 evacuees in Houston have died since the storm. Now, are those going to be counted as hurricane-related deaths? Some of them probably died as a result of the stress. They'll find out, but those 53 bodies aren't counted in that 988.
Okay, so there's that number. Then I gather there are concerns that families may stumble upon the bodies of people they love when they get back to their homes, that the checks haven't been done.
Right, it's been happening with a fair amount of regularity. The problem is that when the government went house to house searching for bodies, they were operating under rules that allowed them to force into a house only under certain circumstances. If there was more than 5 feet of water, if there was obvious signs there was a body inside. But they didn't go into all the houses because they didn't want every single resident of New Orleans to have had their house broken into, and not just New Orleans, but the surrounding suburbs that were also flooded. So now when families are going back, if their house wasn't searched, they're sometimes stumbling upon a body in there. Even if their house was searched, the condition of these houses is so horrible. There's so much mud and muck inside that the searching team might have missed bodies. The bodies could be buried under the muck. And
so what do people do when that happens?
Well, they're supposed to call 911, and there are actually teams standing by for this very occasion, you know, ready to go retrieve bodies from homes where people have stumbled upon loved ones. But it's obviously a pretty, you know, horrid thing to come back and see your house destroyed and then suddenly find a family member lying there who, you know, has been underwater for a month. I can't imagine that's a pleasant experience.
Can't imagine it either. And then on top of that, you say there are bodies that were found that are in custody of the coroner's office but not being released to loved ones.
Right. I mean, the problem is that once you get the body, you give it to the coroner's office for kind of processing and tabulating, then you're supposed to get it back and be able to bury the person. But it's like putting it into a black hole once you give it over to the morgue set up here. It can take, you know, weeks to get the body back because of all these problems with the bureaucracy and all these different, you know, parts of the government fighting each other, the locals, FEMA, and the state. And
very, very sobering picture. Nick Riccardi, Denver Bureau Chief of the Los Angeles Times, been covering the aftermath of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita in Louisiana. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're talking this hour with people who know and love New Orleans about the city's very uncertain future as people return to their homes and take stock of all that's been wiped away. You can join the conversation. Are you still following the news from New Orleans? Is there anything more we can do, should do, in your estimation, to help the city recover? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Houston, Texas, is Michael White. He has an endowed chair in the arts and humanities at Xavier University in New Orleans. He's a composer and clarinet player, renowned musician in New Orleans. He's toured worldwide with his own band, Original Liberty Jazz Band. Until now, he has always lived in New Orleans. We heard at the top of the hour, Algiers Hoodoo Woman from Michael White's latest CD, Dancing in the Sky. And we'll hear more of your music later in the hour. Welcome, Michael White.
Welcome. Thank you very much. Hello.
Hello. And where are you living now?
Well, right now I'm based in Houston, temporarily, until, you know, I find out what's going to happen back home.
Well, tell us something about what you think is happening what you already know has happened back home in New Orleans.
Well, you know, you hear a lot of stories, what you read in the press, what you see on television, and also what a lot of people tell you. I know several people that have gone back home a few times now, and everybody has a different story to tell. We do know that, you know, a lot of the areas in New Orleans are still very much uninhabitable, and that there are still bodies in houses. There is still some flood water in the Ninth Ward section, but everyone reports that they were never as prepared as they thought for what they saw, just the level of destruction. And so,
well,
tell
us your own situation. You had a home. I say past tense. You tell us your home in New Orleans. What's the situation?
Well, had is actually very correct. I had a home in the Gentilly section of New Orleans, and one of the canal breaches, the London Canal breach, was a half block behind my house. So I knew from the aerial photos on the internet that I should have been under about 9 feet of water. Two or three people have seen my house and told me about it, and you know, they did say that I had water up to the roof, and so, you know, I lost everything.
And everything is what?
Well, everything was quite extensive. You know, basic material possessions, well, you can always replace those, but I had quite a few irreplaceable things in my house. I'm really a jazz addict, which I've been for some time, and I've collected many, many things over the years. I have a 4,000-plus CD collection of all types of music, but a lot of jazz, a lot of classic jazz, some rare recordings. I had over 4,000 books, many of them dealing with New Orleans culture, New Orleans music. I had some original sheet music that I had written. I had many photographs, some of them with older musicians with whom I played for many years. Some of them were born as far back as the late 1890s and the early 1900s. Well, those things I can't replace, you know. And I had.
And
I
you're
had
assuming saved, you're assuming they're all gone.
I'm pretty sure from what I'm hearing. You know, someone had gone into my house and looked at things, and you know, everything is just a mess. You know, so I don't think anything can be salvaged.
Michael,
I haven't returned yet, but I'm going back next week.
Oh, well, hold on. We're gonna go to a break. We're talking about New Orleans today through the eyes of people who know and love the city. You can join the conversation. Is the spirit of New Orleans still strong? Can it survive two hurricanes? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to the break with The Truth of the Blues from Michael White's latest CD, Dancing in the Sky. I'm Sheila Cast, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Sheila Cast, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about New Orleans today and the city's uncertain future. You can join the conversation. Will people return to the city? Would you? Is rebuilding the city's infrastructure enough to bring the city back? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us from Houston, Texas, is Michael White. He has an endowed chair in the arts and humanities at Xavier University in New Orleans. He's a composer and clarinet player and renowned musician in New Orleans. And joining me from Covington, Louisiana, is Jason Berry. He's a writer and jazz scholar and the author of Louisiana Faces, Images from a Renaissance, and Up from the Cradle of Jazz, New Orleans Music Since World War II. He's staying with his brother in Covington, Louisiana, and plans to return to his home as soon as electricity is restored there. He's a native of New Orleans. Hello, Jason.
Hi, Sheila. Pleasure to be with you.
And from New York, Douglas Brinkley. He's Distinguished Professor of History and Director of the Theodore Roosevelt Center for American Civilization at Tulane University. He stayed in New Orleans through the hurricane and then left for Houston, where he has been staying in a hotel with his wife and two children. After Hurricane Katrina, he returned to New Orleans and, in a boat, went house to house to rescue survivors. He's working on a book about the aftermath of Hurricanes Rita and Katrina in New Orleans, tentatively titled The Great Deluge. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
How much time are you spending in New Orleans now, Douglas Brinkley?
I'm commuting back and forth between Houston, Interstate 10, I-10, of course, runs from Jacksonville to Santa Monica, and it's one of those interstates that were built that you can really make a lot of time. So I'm doing a commute. I wanted to get my two kids out of harm's way to put them safely in Houston. I'm going back in Baton Rouge and New Orleans trying to collect oral histories, working with different people to find stories of what happened with Katrina, and eventually get a very large collection of this and donate it to the Historic New Orleans Collection, because I think Katrina is a turning point in American history and certainly in Louisiana history, and we want to document it now while people's memories are fresh.
A turning point in what way?
Well, it's the, you know, the cliche line, it's the worst storm to hit North America. I'm not sure that that's true. People will talk about more deaths at Galveston or higher wind velocity in other hurricanes, but clearly the aftermath of Katrina is a breakdown of our system. I've never, to have an organization like FEMA reject private sector supplies, basics, food, water, ice, out of a sense of kind of indifference or bureaucratic inertia, is it bordered on criminal. And then to watch a state government both at the and city of New Orleans and all the Gulf Coast, and the way that the politicians responded to the crisis, they didn't have the citizens prepared, and they didn't respond properly in the aftermath. So it's one of these issues, Katrina, of what went wrong and what we can fix. What I vehemently object to is people that say, "Ah, look, forget what happened. Don't point fingers. Let's just get on to building a new New Orleans." That's half the equation, building the new New Orleans. But in order to build it properly, you have to find what went wrong. And when you do that, you'll find where the crooks and the criminals are. They didn't blow away with the winds off of the Gulf of Mexico. The amount of the people that were engaged in corruption are still operating in Louisiana. And we've got to find out, get rid of those people as soon as possible, and try to get an investigation into what went wrong and things like Rita, where people, died, or at Memorial, a charity hospital.
Jason, let me ask you what it's been like for you to watch your city flooded.
Oh, it's been heartbreaking. I'm a native son. I grew up there. My kids were there. The whole family had to leave. We were scattered in all kinds of directions, like leaves to the wind. I've been going back. Well, I spent almost 5 weeks on the road. I had to get my mother situated in a nursing home in New Iberia, Louisiana. She lived a block from me in New Orleans. My older daughter very much wanted to stay and be part of the rebuilding, and she's 20, and I had to persuade her, as did other family members, that it was better for her to continue with her education. She was a student at Tulane, so I'm grateful to Boston University, where Simonet is now studying. Mm-hmm. Ariel, my little girl, who has Down syndrome, is staying with her mother, my former wife, in Abbeville, Louisiana, out in Cajun country. Melanie, my wife, and I stayed in Lafayette for about 3 weeks with friends as we were trying to figure out all kinds of issues, insurance, housing, and now that we've sort of gotten ourselves stabilized, we came back to Covington, where we rode out the storm. The first 5 days of the storm, we were trapped. The trees that fell in the neighborhood, and I joined an upscale chain gang. We carved out, and then I got poison ivy, which was a horrendous experience. Oh,
that's what you needed on top of everything else.
Yes, and the steroids, which didn't allow me to sleep. But Doug is certainly right that the city and state were packed with corruption, historically always have been. I am much more concerned about the environmental issues, and I don't mean to at all minimize the corruption. I think this storm has exposed the face of social Darwinism in the United States. Congress is governed by a mentality of people who are willing to fight wars on credit cards and hand the debt to the next generation, and I don't know what it's going to take to stop that and bring people to their senses, but I don't see how we can fight the war and rebuild the Gulf South without raising taxes, which is, of course, a sinful concept in this myopic political environment. But
Jason, let's hold the thought on the environmental issues. I want to get right back to that. But first, I want to bring Michael White back in. We talked, Michael, about some of your own loss. But have you been able to reach friends and fellow musicians who played with you? I mean, do you feel like you're in touch with the people who made up your network?
Well, it's kind of strange. Musicians are scattered all over the country, and every day I discover two or three more. Yesterday I got a call from Washington, D.C., and that led to about four or five other guys. So there is that sense of isolation, but everyone is sort of searching for each other. But I have found some of the guys that I work with regularly, and they're all okay.
And so are you optimistic that no news is good news about folks you haven't been able to reach?
Well, that's the thing that concerns me. New Orleans is such a close-knit community, and it's like everyone is like related, like an extended family. And when you hear about a body count nearing 1,000, you know that there are some people there that that you probably have, played music with, that you've seen in parades and funerals or something, and it's kind of a frightening thought to have to face.
Mm. If I might add, we know that Frogman Henry passed away, one of the great R&B singers. Gatemouth Brown, another terrific rhythm and bluesman from the Texas Southwest swing style, died in Orange, Texas, where he had evacuated. And I certainly echo Michael's concerns. I think of so many people I knew and interviewed and loved and watched, and it is a very sad and sobering experience.
You also raised the policy question, though, of environmental concerns, and I didn't give you a chance to actually tell us what's worrying you.
Well, I think the city's polluted, and the stench is overpowering. Compared to Michael, and let me say, Michael, whenever you go into the city, I will be there to help you dig out. I'll put on my gloves, my boots, anything you need. I'm with you, brother.
Thanks, Jason. Same thing, man. We need to make a pact. One day we'll look at your stuff, and one day we'll look at mine.
Well, I'm very fortunate in that sense. My home is all right, and I have a huge collection, and it's okay. But I mean that Michael.
News.
I want to be there with boots on and gloves to help you when. And I hope there are ways to preserve some of these things through air-cooled document salvage retrieval systems, and I really do want to help you if I can.
I hope that works.
Sheila, you know, we know that there were all of these automobiles, my old blue Taurus, one of them, leaking carburetor and oil fluids into the floodwaters, the backup of sewage, the fecal matter, the corpses that we know have been found, you know, on the streets and the roads, and all of this has created an enormous health crisis. And frankly, I don't think the science has ever been done on a level like this. Perhaps Hiroshima offers a parallel, but
so you don't, you really don't know whether it's possible to clean this up.
I don't know. This is not my area of expertise, but it just the stench is so difficult to deal with. And, you know, I was cleaning my house yesterday. I was getting files, actually, and trying to face the specter of my side yard, which had been landscaped and now looks like World War V. And, you know, the National Guard was driving through the neighborhood giving out water you know, these field meals that people eat. And I was so grateful to have the military presence there. But I'm afraid that we will see early mortality rates of people who do go back in on a full-time basis.
Douglas Brinkley, I know you're an historian, not a scientist, so I'm not asking you a scientific question, but you have a home in New Orleans. Do you think you can bring and you have two small children, do you think you can bring your family there, or what's your
thinking? No, absolutely not. I agree with what Jason just said completely. I went out into that water, and the stench is just absolutely overwhelming. And as Jason said, I'd add to the list that he correctly gave, petroleum facilities, petrochemical facilities that have broke loose. On a good day, New Orleans is an environmental hazard zone pre-Katrina. I mean, from Baton Rouge to New Orleans is known as Cancer Alley, and there are incredible documentaries on why a community like Chalmette, which got devastated in the hurricane, has such high rates of cancers and other really fatal ailments that come from these chemicals. And now it's all sort of mixed together with a kind of big public health shrug or indifference on the mad drumbeat to get back and claim New Orleans. And I think you'd be very foolish to bring children there. I think if you're single and want to risk it, it's worth it. But to put other people in environmental and harm's risk at this point in time, it would be, I think, a mistake. We're going to need a lot more months of reassurance and cleanup before I think people should venture back with the family.
Your sense is, while this could be, the silver lining of this cloud could be a chance to rebuild clean, you think maybe it's not going to go in that direction?
Well, that's a good question. That's one of the why we have to stay on the job right now. I mean, the contracts are going out. Although there were no contract bids, and I have to say it's good news FEMA is starting to rein some of those in, but people like the Shaw Group or Bechtel or Halliburton, that a lot of these companies are coming in, and rightfully so. They are the best construction rebuild companies, but they have their own agendas, and it's not necessarily the people's agenda. There's a huge indifference coming from City Hall and Mayor Nagin, and the fact that half of this population's not going to return. They're in a diaspora. They've been absorbed in Houston or Albuquerque, San Jose, and a dozen other cities. But I think we have to ask the questions now, how can we make New Orleans in both built so levees don't break and that we have a canal system modeled on the way the Dutch engineers do it or those in Venice? And secondly, how can we have a greener community? How can we build a new Orleans where we really take environmental concerns seriously? And I'm afraid a lot of these rebuild companies could care less about it. Their job is to extract minerals around the world and do these construction jobs with the least amount of attention to environmental concerns. So it's going to take public watchdog groups to stay on these people, who wants to be part of the new Orleans.
Let's talk to Linda. She's calling us from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hello, Linda.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, how are you?
Great, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm originally from the Boston area, but I've lived in New Orleans for the last 30 years, so I consider that home. And I'm back here in Waltham now as an evacuee and desperate for information, as probably many of the other people are. And I have to agree with Jason that one of my big concerns is environmental. I am very lucky. My partner and I, he evacuated to Houston. I was already here for work. And we just are terrified of what we're going to see. We're going to go back in the middle of the month, even though we haven't been called by our zip code. But we know that our neighbor's pool is full of sewer water and the stink is horrible. But we are still hopeful. We love the city of New Orleans. My partner, he's from there. I've considered home for the last 30 years. And we're just not going to give up, but we do have a huge concern about the environmental impact.
Jason,
we haven't even mentioned the dreaded word mold.
That's right.
Which is what's really one of the concerns of people in houses. It's if you look at the list nationally of people with allergies, New Orleans is one of the worst places to live, and now people that are experiencing mold are fleeing the metropolitan area after going back to their house for a day or two because their head swells up. From the allergic reaction.
There's another side to this, and perhaps this is taking a cue on my part from what Linda just said. You know, we have to make the city come back. We cannot let it sink into the Gulf of Mexico. And I think of the people at universities. I spoke on the phone the other day with Father Wiles, the president of Loyola. I'm sure Doug has been in touch with the authorities at Tulane, where he teaches, and it's going to be a challenge of the first order for the universities, not so much to have the classes ready to go, because thankfully Tulane and Loyola were in an area that did not flood. Now Xavier, where Michael teaches, unfortunately did flood. What all the universities face, whether they flooded or not, is how do you attract students back to a city which has so many great amenities culturally, and yet now has this terrible, specter, both of an area rife with crime because of what we saw at the convention center and in the Dome.
Linda, thanks for the call. I'm Sheila Cast, and this is On Point. Michael, do you think Xavier will have students and faculty? Xavier has said it will reopen in January, correct?
Yes, that's correct. And, you know, I think a lot of us are worried about cultural issues and economic issues. I wonder if New Orleans will ever be the same, if I'll ever see a jazz funeral again, if I'll ever get to see the unique types of characters that we have in New Orleans that really couldn't survive anywhere else, that walk down the street in powder blue Stacy Adams shoes and purple hats and somehow, you know, when they walk down the street, people say, oh, you're clean, you know. I think somewhere else they would lock them up. So, you know, but I think the number one issue here is environmental. We have to make sure that people are safe. And I think that that takes precedence over everything else. And I think the politicians have the responsibility to be very realistic with the public about what we're facing. And I haven't seen that yet.
We're talking this hour with people who know and love New Orleans about the future of their city. You can join the conversation. What are you hearing from family, from friends who lived in New Orleans? Evacuees, do you plan to return? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to the break with Creole Nights from Michael White's latest CD, Dancing in the Sky. I'm Sheila Cast. This is On Point. Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services, in Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com. This is On Point. I'm Sheila Cast, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about New Orleans today and its uncertain future with people who know and love the city. You can join the conversation. Are you still following the news from New Orleans? Is there more we should be doing to help the city recover? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. With us from Houston, Texas, is Michael White. He has an endowed chair in the arts and humanities at Xavier University in New Orleans. He's a composer and clarinet player, a famous musician in New Orleans. From Covington, Louisiana, with Jason Berry. He's a writer and jazz scholar and author of Louisiana Faces, Images from a Renaissance, and Up from the Cradle of Jazz, New Orleans Music Since World War II. And from New York, Douglas Brinkley, Distinguished Professor of History and Director of the Theodore Roosevelt Center for American Civilization at Tulane University. He's working on a book on the aftermath of the hurricanes of Rita and Katrina in New Orleans, tentatively called The Great Deluge. Let's talk to Thomas, who's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, Sheila, and hi. Thanks for this subject. It's a great show. I just wanted to share some of my memories. I was in New Orleans for the second time in 2001. I was first in Lafayette and then in New Orleans for the music festivals, the Festival International in Lafayette, and then the Jazz and Heritage Festival. And I just had an amazing time. And I'm wondering whether I also had the. It was great to see Dr. Michael White perform at that festival. And I wanted to just make a push for. I hope that next. I mean, now is recovery. Now is getting people back on their feet. But I think next April and May, when the next Jazz and Heritage Festival is scheduled to take place, that's going to be an amazing turnout of musicians and of people coming flooding into New Orleans, coming into New Orleans to support that festival. And I wanted to get Michael White's impressions of that, whether that is actually feasible, whether that's going to happen from his perspective here in October of 2005.
Well, I have to be honest with you. I'm pretty apprehensive because, you know, we all want to see New Orleans become as much of what it was as possible. But realistically, I think, again, we have to deal with those environmental issues, and we have to demand that the politicians and people in the position to do the proper testing and to be real with us about what's going on in terms of the germs, the mold, the threats from the mosquitoes and all of those things and what we need to do to stay healthy. I think we need to push for that more than anything else because, you know, it's a very, very complex issue and, you know, the general public is left out without really knowing what's going on. And
Michael, where do you expect that you will be for at Mardi Gras time next spring? Paris or New York?
Well,
San Francisco?
You know, Mardi Gras time, Xavier will be open, and technically I probably should be in my class.
Can you envision that? Is that a live idea in your brain?
I certainly hope so. I certainly hope that tomorrow, you know, they're going to, you know, come out with some kind of report to the people about what's going on and what plans they have. But realistically, again, I think it's really beyond me to really understand the environmental issues. I think I don't know if the proper scientists are working on, you know, like I said, testing and things, and that needs to be done. I mean, you know, we want to go back, but you can't just go back the way it is.
Douglas Brinkley, what do you think? Can New Orleans rise from the rubble in a year, 2 years, 10 years?
It will rise from the rubble. I'm certain of it. Just listening to Michael White's Creole Night, you get kind of the chills and you realize that the music and culture of New Orleans is enduring and it will rise again. The problem, and it's something that Michael, Jason, and I are all touching on this environmental issue, is if you look at City Hall and look at Mayor Nagin, what you're getting for your message is come on back And we're given a lot of draconian measures that are going on, the laying off of 3,000 workers in a very cold political fashion. Why aren't we saying, if you want students to come back to Tulane with the parents, Tulane are about 70-80% people from the Northeast, really. If you want those parents to write big checks to send their kids to New Orleans, you've got to let them know the city's environmentally safe, that they're not sending their children into a hazard zone, and we get not a peep out of that. Why? Why isn't City Hall saying a word about the environment? It's because the National Health Institute, Centers for Disease Control, any public health worker won't green light New Orleans right now. So it puts City Hall in a quandary. They want to get people back to work, but nobody's willing to say it's not an environmental hazard zone that's an authority. And so it's a dilemma. I think
so
the
what
environmental...
should they do?
That what they need to do is get a full reading, the best we can, with the best people, on what are the environmental hazards in New Orleans. They exist. Put them out there in a realistic fashion. If it stops some people from coming back, if it slows the commerce down, so be it. You've got to put people in front of money, and that's something that the city of New Orleans has not done in recent years, or the state of Louisiana, and we've paid a terrible cost for that during Katrina. The levee broke because of shoddy construction. These sorts of issues now have to be studied, and the mayor needs to start addressing the truth. Politicians in a crisis have to tell the truth, not the, you know, gilded scenario they want people to believe.
Let's talk to Ron. Ron is calling us from Medford, Massachusetts. Hello, Ron.
Hi, how you doing?
Pretty good. How about you?
Oh, I'm doing okay. I'm a Dillard University professor in New Orleans, and I got out the day before and drove up to Boston with my family. I'm originally from Malden, and I have a house in Gentilly, which was under about 8 feet of water. So I think that Nagin is really trying to cover up with one of the main issues, which is there's probably 100,000 people like me, basically working class, houses in the working class neighborhoods of Gentilly in New Orleans East, and nobody knows what's going to happen with those neighborhoods. When are people going to be allowed to rebuild? What are the houses going to have to be like? Is there going to be flood insurance? And it's just such a major segment of the city, and there's so few resources. What's he going to do? Well, I don't know why they're allowing people to go back at
all. Jason, what would you say to Ron?
Well, I think he's articulating a concern that many people have. You know, I drove yesterday through Lakeview and parts of Gentilly, and the water line is emblazoned like some muddy horizontal tattoo on many of these homes. And we're not getting straight information from City Hall. Are the homes going to be bulldozed? If they're bulldozed, do people get fair market value? Will the insurance companies step in and provide people with the value of their lost furniture and things? The rebuilding questions are enormous, and I think what Nagin has done, unfortunately, is staked his career, frankly, on trying to get people back into town. You can do that in the Garden District. You can do it in parts of the French Quarter. And it's great to get people to come back and, you know, start putting a human face on the city, but there are gigantic reconstruction questions, and there's just a void of information.
Michael White, do you think that there's a way to carry on New Orleans culture while there's rebuilding, before there's rebuilding, or even if there's not sufficient rebuilding from outside?
Well, yes. One of the things that I've been doing, because I've been trying to figure out what can I do about this. I mean, this is such a serious thing. You know, I think about New Orleans. I've traveled all over the world, and I still have to say New Orleans has the richest, most unique culture that I've seen anywhere. And it's a beautiful culture, and it needs to survive. And, you know, some of us have tried to start touring, spreading the word. I have a program on New Orleans jazz and history that I do, and we're starting to tour and around the country and do that kind of thing. I think that's such an important thing because that represents the spirit of the people, the culture, the music.
Let me thank all of you because you've raised wonderful points that all of us need to think about. Michael White, endowed chair in the arts and clarinetist, Douglas Brinkley, Distinguished Professor of History at Tulane, Jason Berry, writer and jazz scholar. Thanks to all of you. We're ending this conversation with Dancing in the Sky from Michael White's CD by that name. The song is written in the New Orleans jazz funeral tradition. For more information on the music you heard today, go to our website, onpointradio.org. In a moment, Jack Beatty joins us for a look at the new leadership of the Supreme Court. This is On Point.
Dancing in the sky when they bring my body by. They know I'll be joining them in heaven. That ruckus will be mine, the eternal second line that there'll be when I join them in heaven. My life on this earth surely does have its worth, but I know that it's better with the Lord. Upcoming day, I know they'll make a way for me to be dancing in the sky.
The life of the law has not been logic, it has been experience, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes maintained. John Roberts would seem to disagree.
On Point News analyst Jack Beatty.
Behind the questions put to Roberts at his confirmation hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee by even Republican senators like Ohio's Mike DeWine, one sensed an anxiety that for Roberts, logic came first, that his mastery of cases, precedents, and procedures might mask a human deficiency, a want of compassion for those who look to the Supreme Court for justice, for the black girl in Topeka's segregated schools who colored God white in her drawings, for the non-believing boy made to recite a prayer every morning in a suburban New York school, for indigent Clarence Gideon convicted of breaking and entering by a Florida court that refused to supply him with a lawyer, for women forced by state laws to bear unwanted children, for young men arrested for making love, for the dissenters, the heretics, the protesters, even the despised flag burners. The experiences of people like these have shaped court rulings that sought to right the great wrong of American history, widen the boundaries of liberty, and check the power of state over citizen. Does Roberts believe such experiences are the life of the law? Will he construe the law by what Holmes called its syllogisms or respond to, quote, the felt necessities of the time? Those questions hang over John Roberts as he ascends to leadership of the High Court.
Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst and senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Jack joins me now from Hanover, New Hampshire. So, Jack, hello. Even as you are raising these questions about John Roberts as he wraps up his first week as Chief Justice, we also saw President Bush nominate Harriet Myers for Justice, Sandra Day O'Connor's seat. Your thoughts?
Yeah, yes, we did. And, you know, Justice Holmes in that quote talks about experience. And I know that people are, there's a tide now of sort of condescension that's breaking around Harriet Myers' qualifications for the court. But let's look at her experience. She shared really the defining experience of women in her generation trying to get ahead in male-dominated professions. At SMU, when she was in the law school there, the professors said to young women, why are you taking positions, seats that should go to the men? She was denied admittance to a business club in Dallas. She had to fight her way every day against the suspicion, and more than that, that she was inferior, that she couldn't cut it, that she wasn't up to the standard set by these men. Now, that's an experience of marginalization. And that experience of being the odd woman out, of being isolated and scorned, that's the kind of situation that minorities share always in a majority rule society. And those kinds of decisions come before the court.
But we really don't have a sense, of, because we don't have a judicial record from her, of whether that experience that you've outlined will inform her judgments.
We don't. We don't. But we have precedent. Samuel Miller was one of the great justices of the late 19th century. He had very little legal experience. He was a physician. But his central experience was opposition, the main experience of his generation, to slavery. And Lincoln appointed him to the court, and that guided, that view of the great wrong of slavery guided many of his decisions in the post-war era. And it made him a great justice because he transferred that experience forward. We don't have any guarantee that this will happen. It didn't happen with Clarence Thomas, God knows, the triumph of affirmative action, who's voted against affirmative action.
And I also remember when Antonin Scalia was appointed, he spoke to an Italian-American group and kind of couldn't understand why they were all excited. He didn't really see that part of his experience as particularly relevant.
Yes, that's true. That's true. So these things can happen. But look at the experience of John Roberts, a hermetic legal existence, excellence from the cradle forward. Again, tremendous intellectual experience, but is there some education of the heart there? One doesn't know. I'm just struck with the way this woman has quietly, everyone says that about her, but she had to be quiet in that world, reached out and tried to help other women in similar situations. And, you know, not only did she have to fight against male condescension going up, once there she had to fight against the recognition that people will always say, well, it's because you're a woman. And, of course, that's exactly what they're saying again. So that even triumph is robbed of its savor.
Do you think that's part of the reason that some conservatives are worried about her? Because they expect that, I love that phrase, education of the heart.
I don't know, but when I see the lofty, scornful, supercilious George Will, opining about her, lack of qualifications to the court, I'd take her any day over him. And just on those grounds of experience and of the heart, I'd gamble on it.
So how quickly do you think she's going to be confirmed?
I don't know. She may, there's a chance she could even be withdrawn. President Bush has taken a hit for this. He was 41% in the polls before her nomination, now 37, and he's down to 79% among Republicans. He's not been below 80% yet among Republicans. So this is, it would seem extraordinary for him to withdraw the nomination, but these things have happened. But I think that once she's on that, once she's before that committee, I can't imagine Ted Kennedy, giving her a hard time or not appreciating the struggles she has had in her life, which he has no idea of. And I suspect that she would be confirmed.
Jack Beatty is On Point news analyst. He spoke with us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Thanks.
Thank you, Sheila.
I'm Sheila Cast, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.